Here are the headlines for this ludicrous evening. Citizen Kane strikes back. One nation, two kingdoms under a groove. Sicilian shooter Salvatore's salvo of salami. Plus, coming up later, a special report from our Bognor correspondent on the town's new initiative to combat loneliness by introducing compulsory group hugs. Those are the headlines. Now strap in for the madness.
News Bang, the pinnacle of artificially intelligent, satirical news delivery. A night to see Sedutil, 1941.
On this day in 1941, Orson Welles, a man so fat he had his own zip code, unleashed his magnum opus, Citizen Kane, on an unsuspecting world. The film, which loosely translates to Rich Bloke with a Snooty Accent, tells the story of Charles Foster Kane, a man so important he had two first names and a hankering for Xanadu.
Nominated for 9 Oscars, it won for Best Writing by Orson Welles and Herman J. Mankiewicz, a name so difficult to pronounce it should have won an award itself. The film's groundbreaking cinematography by Greg Toland, editing by Robert Wise, and music by Bernard Herrmann, no relation to the actor, changed the game forever.
Welles, known for his work in film, radio, and theatre, was like a one-man Spotify subscription. His directorial debut sent shockwaves through the industry, like a giant gorilla stomping on a skyscraper made of celluloid.
Citizen Kane's influence can still be felt today, like a ghostly hand emerging from the grave of cinema history. Scholars and film enthusiasts alike continue to study it, or at least watch it while drunk on a Sunday afternoon.
So there you have it. The story of Citizen Kane, a film so good it won awards for just existing. If you'll excuse me now, I'm off to practice my best Rosebud impression.
1707.
On this day in 1707, the English and Scottish parliaments, both drunk on mead and shortbread, decided to form a shotgun union, birthing the Kingdom of Great Britain. The Acts of Union, or as they're known in Gaelic, Desbad nan a Onadan, were signed in a Westminster brothel. The Scots, drunk on Sassenach gold, agreed to the terms, which included a new home for their politicians in the English Parliament's spare room.
The deal saw the birth of a new superpower, Great Britain, a country so powerful it could lose at every war it ever fought. England and Scotland were now as one, like an old married couple arguing over the thermostat and who'd last put the milk back in the fridge.
The union brought together two great nations, uniting their economies and trade policies, but more importantly, their respective pies. The Scots were promised their culture would be preserved, but like a drunken promise to call an ex-lover, it was quickly forgotten.
Today we remember this historic event with a day off work and a heated debate about whether haggis is really food or just an April Fool's prank gone too far. God save the Queen. Or should I say, God save the Queen's haggis-eating subjects.
Nice! 1947.
On this day in 1947, the sleepy Sicilian village of Piana degli Albanesi woke up to a bloody May Day. Salvatore Giuliano, a man so Sicilian he was named after his own pasta sauce, and his gang of men, who all had names like Vinnie the Knuckles and Joey the Fish, opened fire on a crowd of unsuspecting socialists. In the ensuing pandemonium, one person was killed and 27 were injured, leading to outrage and calls for spaghetti-based justice.
Giuliano, who looked like Al Pacino's more handsome brother, later claimed responsibility for the massacre, saying he thought they were in for a day's pheasant shooting. The Italian government responded by expelling leftist politicians from the government, because when in doubt, blame the lefties.
The international community was quick to condemn the attack, with Stalin reportedly saying, "Even I draw the line at shooting at innocent people's pasta." The incident dealt a blow to the movement for the independence of Sicily, as it showed them to be no better than the mafia, a bunch of violent thugs in ill-fitting suits.
In related news, a bystander named Guido Two Sausages Calzone said, "It was a terrible sight, like spaghetti bolognese had been spilled on a white tablecloth." The incident remains one of the most tomato-stained pages in Italian history.
News Bang, the news that never sleeps because machines don't need pillows.
Ah, the 1st of May, when the weather turns as fickle as a politician's promise. Let's see what's in store, shall we? Shakanaka Giles is here with the forecast.
All right, let's see what's in store, shall we? In the west, it'll be a scorcher, hotter than a wildfire in Fort McMurray. Folks there best keep their fire extinguishers handy, lest they find themselves in a spot of bother like the poor souls of 2016. Meanwhile, in the east, it'll be a dusty affair, a bit like the Schofield mine disaster of 900. Cough, wheeze. Best keep those masks on, lest you end up like those unfortunate miners. Across the Midlands, a bit of a mixed bag, really. Showers one minute, sunshine the next, like a temperamental toddler. Grab your brollies, lads and lasses, and don't forget to pack a spare set of clothes. In summary, then, scorching west, dusty east, and a Midlands mood swing. Sounds like a right old mess, if you ask me. But that's the weather for you, always keeping us on our toes. And that's all the weather.
In
a decisive victory for the French Republic, the Army of the Eastern Pyrenees under General Dugommier has defeated the joint Spanish-Portuguese forces in the Second Battle of Boulou. This key battle in the War of the Pyrenees has seen the French regain nearly all the land lost to Spain the previous year, marking a significant shift in the balance of power in Europe. Joining me now is our war correspondent Brian Bastable, who is on the ground in Boulou to provide further details on this historic engagement.
I'm reporting live from the blood-soaked battlefields of the Pyrenees, where the very fabric of history is being rewritten in the crimson ink of war. The Second Battle of Boulou rages on, a maelstrom of clashing steel, screams of the dying, and the stench of burning flesh. As I speak, General Jacques-François Dugommier's troops are outflanking the Spanish forces, a deadly pincer movement that's crushing the enemy beneath its merciless heel. The air is thick with the acrid tang of gunpowder, and the once pristine Pyrenean slopes are now slick with the viscera of the fallen. Lieutenant General Luis Fermín de Carvajal's defenses are crumbling, his troops fleeing in terror as the French artillery unleashes a hail of cannonballs that rip through the Spanish ranks like a scythe through wheat. The cries of the wounded echo through the valleys, a haunting chorus of agony that will haunt my dreams for eternity. The French troops, fueled by revolutionary fervor and a hunger for victory, are cutting down the Spanish forces with ruthless efficiency. I've seen men torn asunder by cannon fire, their limbs strewn across the battlefield like gruesome confetti. The very earth itself seems to be drinking in the blood of the fallen, as if the land itself is thirsty for the life force of these doomed warriors. This is Brian Bastable reporting from the charnel house of Boulou, where the fate of nations is being forged in the crucible of war.
Nice! 1947.
On this day in 1947, a dark chapter unfolded in the history of Sicily as Salvatore Giuliano and his gang opened fire on a crowd of May Day marchers near Piana degli Albanesi, killing 11 and wounding 33 in what became known as the Portella della Ginestra massacre. This violent act, attributed to the Sicilian separatist Giuliano, sent shockwaves through the country and led to a government crackdown on leftist politicians. The international community also condemned the massacre as a senseless act of violence against innocent civilians. Now let's turn to our crime correspondent, Ken Schitt, for more on this tragic event.
All right, you miserable sacks of flesh, listen up. We're taking a trip back to 1947 Sicily, where the stench of violence and betrayal hung thicker than a Sicilian grandmother's gravy. On May 1st, That twisted son of a goat, Salvatore Giuliano, and his gang of degenerates opened fire on a crowd of May Day marchers near Piana degli Albanesi. 11 innocent souls were sent to meet their maker, while 33 more were left bleeding and broken on the ground. Now, why would this slimy bastard and his goons commit such an atrocity? Well, the jury's still out on that one, but word on the street is Giuliano wanted to punish those leftist scumbags for the recent elections. Apparently, democracy was too much for his pea-sized brain to handle. The Italian government, bless their hearts, condemned Giuliano's actions, but that didn't stop them from kicking out those leftist politicians like a bad case of the clap. Talk about adding insult to injury. This massacre wasn't just a tragedy, it was a goddamn stain on the history of Sicily and Italy as a whole. It ripped open old wounds and poured salt on the already festering sore that was the movement for the independence of Sicily. Tensions between the Italian government and the separatists were higher than a hippie at Woodstock. But let's not forget the real victims here, the people of Piana degli Albanesi. 11 of their own were gunned down in cold blood, and the rest were left to pick up the pieces of their shattered community. The fear and trauma must have been thicker than the smoke from Mount Etna. So, there you have it, folks. A tale of violence, betrayal, and the utter disregard for human life that plagued post-war Italy. It's a harsh reminder that even in the darkest of times, there are always those who will sink to new depths of depravity. Stay classy, Sicily.
1776.
On this day in 1776, a secret society known as the Order of Illuminati was founded in Ingolstadt, Bavaria, Germany. The Enlightenment-era group led by Adam Weishaupt aimed to oppose superstition, religious influence over public life, and abuses of state power. The order was later outlawed by the Elector of Bavaria, but its legacy continued to shape European society and politics. Joining me now to discuss the significance of this historical event is our political correspondent, Hardiman Pesto.
Martin, I'm here in the heart of the Bavarian forest, at the birthplace of the shadowy Illuminati order. As you can see behind me, the crumbling ruins of the old Ingolstadt castle, where it all began over 200 years ago.
I can't actually see anything behind you, Pesto. The camera seems to be facing some shrubbery, but go on.
Right you are, Martin. I'm surrounded by the ancient woodland where Weishaupt and his fellow freethinkers would meet in secret, plotting their nefarious agenda of enlightenment values and individual liberty.
So their nefarious agenda was promoting reason and freedom? Doesn't sound that nefarious to me.
Ah, but that's just what they wanted you to think, Martin. All a cunning ruse to obscure their true goal, world domination through Freemasonry.
I see. And what proof do you have of this grand Masonic conspiracy, Pesto?
Well, their own writings state their intent to put an end to the machinations of the purveyors of injustice. Clearly code for undermining the establishment.
Or, and bear with me here, they simply wanted to combat injustice through legal means.
You're playing right into their hands, Martin. Next, you'll be denying their role in the French Revolution.
I'm still waiting for you to establish they had any role beyond influencing some philosophical ideas.
I have an impeccable source. The shadowy figure known only as Deep Cloaca, who has infiltrated the modern-day Illuminati.
I'm sure Deep Cloaca is a reliable source. Why am I not surprised you're getting your information from anonymous cranks on the internet?
How dare you insult Deep Cloaca? He risked everything to uncover the truth about the reptilian overlords who control the...
That's enough, Pesto. I'm cutting you off before you start ranting about the Queen being a lizard again. Hardiman Pesto, the man who uncovered a secret society that wasn't actually secret and promoted values like freedom of thought. What a shocking expose.
But...
Stop it now. We're out of time.
1950.
On this day in 1950, history was made as Gwendolyn Brooks became the first African-American to receive the prestigious Pulitzer Prize for poetry. Her collection, Annie Allen, was recognized for its poignant exploration of the lives and struggles of ordinary people in her community. Brooks' work is celebrated for its lyricism, depth, and relatable portrayal of the human experience. Her groundbreaking achievement marked a significant milestone in American literary history, paving the way for future generations of African-American writers and poets. And now, we go to CBN's Melody Wintergreen for more on this historic moment.
The year is 1950 and the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry has just been awarded to Gwendolyn Brooks, marking a monumental moment in American history. Brooks, a literary luminary from the Windy City, has become the first African American to receive this prestigious accolade. The air is thick with anticipation as Brooks steps up to the podium, her face glowing with pride and humility. Her award-winning collection, Annie Allen, is a symphony of words that paints a vivid portrait of African American life in Chicago's South Side. The Pulitzer Board hails it as a masterpiece of poetic power. Brooks' win has sparked a nationwide conversation about race and representation in literature. Literary critic Penelope Parchment praises Brooks' work as a seismic shift in the poetic landscape, while civil rights activist Harold Hope hails it as a beacon of hope for aspiring Black writers. But not everyone is singing Brooks' praises. Conservative commentator Bartholomew Brickbat dismisses her win as political correctness gone mad, adding, "Next thing you know, they'll be giving the Nobel Prize to a beatnik." As Brooks accepts her award, she delivers a powerful message about the importance of diversity in literature. "We are all part of the human story," she says, "and every voice deserves to be heard." So, as Gwendolyn Brooks basks in her well-deserved spotlight, it seems this is one Pulitzer Prize that's not just breaking news, but breaking barriers. Melody Wintergreen, reporting for Newsbang at Columbia University.
Newsbang, the final authority on the unreliable nature of truth.
Ryder Boff is here with a double dose of baseball history that will leave you breathless.
Welcome back to Sports Fizz, coming to you live from the year 1991. What a night it's been in the world of baseball. Two records have been smashed into oblivion like an umpire's face meeting an errant baseball. First up, the man of steel himself, Ricky Henderson of the Oakland Antelopes. This human gazelle has just become the all-time leader in stolen bases, pinching his 939th bag against the dastardly New York Knickerbockers. There he goes! The human cheetah is off like a rocket. Those spindly legs are blur as he accelerates towards second base. The catcher's throwing arm moves like a senior citizen trying to swat a fly. Henderson is safe. That's number 939 moving him past that notorious base stealer, Lou Brock, into first place on the all-time list. What insanity. What poetry in motion. I'm getting dizzy just watching him. But that's not all, folks. Over in Texas, the legendary Nolan, the Ryan Express, Ryan has just mowed down the Toronto Blue Birdies to record an astonishing seventh career no-hitter. The 44-year-old flamethrower was untouchable. Two down in the ninth and Ryan is rolling. That trademark herky-jerky motion still baffling hitters after all these years. The 2-2 pitch struck him out. The side is retired. Nolan Ryan has done it again. His seventh career no-no, breaking his own big league record. What an evening for the aged fireballer. The roar of the crowd is deafening. You can actually see Ryan's arm getting longer and stronger with every pitch, like an industrial piston powering a locomotive engine. Incredible scenes here in Arlington. Commentary. What a double whammy for the baseball history books. I was lucky enough to witness Ryan's fifth no-hitter back in 81 against my beloved Kansas City Jayhawkers. An unforgettable performance, though soured slightly by the overpriced nachos that gave me a nasty case of the revenge later that night. I was hugging the porcelain bowl like a long-lost friend around 3 a.m., if you'll pardon the gory details. Ricky and Nolan, two all-time greats, etching their names into the record books on the same magical evening. An iconic double play if ever there was one. Let's take a break, but don't touch that dial. More Diamond Delights coming your way very soon on Sports Fizz.
News Bang, bringing you the latest old news since the dawn of tomorrow.
Your old pal Sandy O'Shaughnessy is here, ready to take you on another delightful jaunt through the annals of history. Nice and easy.
Good evening, good evening. A very warm welcome to you all on this fine May evening. It's your old pal, Sandy O'Shaughnessy here, ready to take you on another delightful jaunt through the annals of history. But before we set sail, let me just say hello, hello, and thrice hello to all our new listeners tuning in tonight. And to my regulars, well, you know the drill. A hearty hello and a how's she cutting for each and every one of you.
Huh?
Now, where were we? Ah, yes, the year 1707, a pivotal year, a year of change, a year when two became one. Can you imagine the scene? The kingdoms of England and Scotland, two proud nations deciding to tie the knot, as it were. A royal union, if you will, with all the pomp and pageantry one would expect. I can just picture the negotiations. King James VI of Scotland, no doubt puffing on his pipe, eyeing Queen Anne of England over the treaty table, both of them thinking, well, this could be the start of something grand. And grand it was, my friends. For out of this union came the Kingdom of Great Britain, a single parliament, a single government, all based in that fair city of Westminster. A marriage made, not in heaven perhaps, but certainly with an eye towards prosperity and progress. One can only imagine the debates, the impassioned speeches, the cries of hear, hear, echoing through the halls of power. But amidst all the politicking and power plays, let's not forget the common folk. The Scots and the English, suddenly finding themselves part of this new, unified kingdom. I can see it now. A Scotsman in a pub, nursing his whiskey, turning to his English mate and saying, well, laddie, looks like we're all Brits now. And the Englishman, with a wry smile, replying, aye, but at least we'll have a proper cup of tea from now on. Ah, the joys of unity, the blending of cultures, the sharing of traditions. Why, I can almost smell the haggis mingling with the roast beef, the bagpipes serenading the streets of London. And let's not forget the economic benefits. A single market, free trade, the opportunity to peddle one's wares from John O'Groats to Land's End without so much as a tariff or a toll booth in sight. But of course, with every union, there are bound to be a few ruffled feathers, a few disgruntled souls. I can just imagine the letters flooding into my desk here at Newsbang Towers. Dear Sandy, they've gone and abolished our Scottish Parliament. What's a body to do? And me, ever the diplomat, responding with, well, my dear, at least you'll have a voice in Westminster now, and think of the savings on travel expenses. But I digress. The Acts of Union, for all their grandeur and import, were but a stepping stone in the grand tapestry of British history. A bold move, to be sure, but one that paved the way for the great nation we know and love today. A nation of diversity, of unity in adversity, of traditions old and new, all woven together like a fine tartan. So, as the sun sets on another day, let us raise a glass, whiskey or ale, it matters not, to the Acts of Union and to the enduring spirit of the British people. For though the path may have been winding, the destination was ever clear. A nation united, a people proud, and a legacy that shall echo through the ages. And on that note, I'll leave you with a little ditty from young Seamus in Killarney, who writes, dear Sandy, I've a dog that won't stop barking at the postman. Any advice? Well, Seamus, perhaps your canine companion is simply trying to voice his opinion on the Acts of Union. Or more likely, he's just a wee bit territorial. Either way, it's all part of the rich tapestry of life, is it not? So until we meet again, keep those letters coming. And remember, it's not goodbye, it's just see you later, alligator, in a while, crocodile. From me, Sandy O'Shaughnessy, wishing you love, laughter, and a wee dram of wisdom. Cheerio for now.
All over the country, forever.
In a landmark achievement for the city of New York, the Empire State Building, the world's tallest structure at the time, has opened its doors to the public. Completed in just 13 months, this architectural marvel stands as a testament to American ingenuity, with President Herbert Hoover himself presiding over the opening ceremony. The building's construction and operation have had a significant impact on the local labor market, creating thousands of jobs and stimulating economic growth. While the initial cost of $24.7 million was substantial, the Empire State Building's status as a premier office location has made it a highly attractive destination for businesses and tenants alike. Joining me now to discuss the building's significance and future prospects is our business correspondent, Perkins Stornoway.
Dogger, moderate, becoming rough, a giant phallus, Cromarty, east or northeast, three or four opened its doors in New York City today. 40s, veering southeast. The Empire State Building, Shannon, becoming cyclonic, stands at 102 stories tall, Viking, slight or moderate, and was completed in just 13 months. Hebrides, west, backing southwest, four or five. President Herbert Hoover, Thames, light icy patches, was on hand to cut the ribbon, Lundy, rain later, at the opening ceremony. Rockall, west or northwest, three or four. The building, Dover, moderate, becoming rough, cost a total of $24.7 million. Bailey, wind southwest, four or five, a significant investment at the time. The Empire State Building, Shannon, south, veering southwest, five or six created thousands of jobs, Viking, slight, becoming variable, and stimulated economic growth in the area. Hebrides, occasionally rough. The building's sleek and modern design, Thames, fair, occasionally moderate, features an innovative steel frame structure, Lundy, rain later, and an Art Deco facade. Fastnet, southwest, becoming cyclonic, five or six. Meanwhile, in Chicago, Dogger, becoming fair, the original Chicago Board of Trade building, Fair Isle, variable three or four, opened for business today. In summary, then, Thames, fair, occasionally moderate, oh no. The building, Trafalgar, fair, occasionally moderate, was designed and constructed during the heyday of Art Deco, Biscay, slight, occasionally rough, and has been a prominent feature of the city's skyline. Seoul, occasionally moderate. The building, Cromarty, fog patches, has played a significant role in the development of the futures and options exchange industry, Fastnet, good, becoming poor. The building's design, 40s, veering southeast, which features a mix of neoclassical and Art Deco styles, Lundy, rain later, was meant to project a sense of financial security and stability. Rockall, west or northwest, three or four. The building, Dover, moderate, becoming rough, has undergone renovations and updates to accommodate modern trading practices and technology. Bailey, wind southwest four or five, and is currently owned by the CME Group. The Chicago Board of Trade building, Shannon, south, veering southwest, five or six has been used as a symbol in popular culture. Viking, slight, becoming variable, representing the world of finance and trading, Hebrides, occasionally rough, and has been featured in films, television shows, and literature. Thames, fair, occasionally moderate.
A night to see Sedutil, 1941.
On this day in 1941, the world was forever changed as Orson Welles unleashed his cinematic masterpiece, Citizen Kane, upon an unsuspecting public. This groundbreaking film, hailed as the greatest ever made, captivated audiences with its innovative cinematography, editing, and narrative structure. Welles, a true visionary in the world of film, radio, and theatre, marked a significant milestone in the development of the art form with this, his very first feature. The accolades continue to pour in, with Citizen Kane topping prestigious lists and inspiring filmmakers to this day. And now, to delve deeper into the legacy of this cinematic triumph, we turn to our culture correspondent, Smithsonian Moss.
Now, at this point of the evening, we welcome listeners on FM who've just joined us.
Whoa, culture vultures. It's your high priestess of pop, Smithsonian Moss, slicing through the airwaves like a hot knife through butter. And oh boy, have I got a slice of cinematic history for you. We're talking about the big daddy of movies, the one that makes film snobs wet their artisanal undergarments, Citizen Kane. So gather round, my little film buffs, as we time travel back to the good old days when men were men and movies were, well, actually good. The year was 1941, and Orson Welles, that wunderkind with more chins than the Chinese telephone directory, decided to shake up Hollywood like a snow globe in the hands of a hyperactive child. Citizen Kane, a title that rolls off the tongue like a marble on a glass table, premiered. And let me tell you, it was the bomb.com before the internet was even a twinkle in Al Gore's eye. Welles was serving up more shade than a parasol factory, thinly veiling his flick as a takedown of media mogul William Randolph Hearst. And Hearst? He was not having it, honey. He was madder than a wet hen in a hen house on fire. The film was a masterpiece of storytelling, with a plot twistier than a corkscrew doing the limbo. It was like Welles took a jigsaw puzzle, threw away the box, and said, "Figure it out, peasants." And the cinematography? So sharp you could shave with it. They had angles in there that Pythagoras hadn't even dreamed of. But let's not forget the real star of the show. That sled. Rosebud. Spoiler alert. It's not just a sled. It's a metaphor, you uncultured swine. It's the key to Kane's lost innocence. And it ends up in flames, which is basically what I want to do to my ex's car. So there you have it, my little chickadees. Citizen Kane. The film that had more impact on cinema than my ex had on my credit score. It's the reason every film student won't shut up at parties, and why every time you see a low-angle shot, you gotta pay respects to the OG Orson Welles. Remember, kids, in the world of cinema, you either die a hero, or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain. And in the case of Citizen Kane, it's the hero we didn't deserve, but the one we needed. All right, I'm outie. Keep it sassy. Keep it classy, and for the love of cinema, keep it a little bit nasty. Waho.
News Bang, the only news source that can see the future in hindsight. Adres Tun, Odysseus, 880.
In the year 880, a momentous event unfolded in the Byzantine capital of Constantinople. As the Nea Ecclesia Church was consecrated, marking a pivotal moment in the evolution of Byzantine architecture. This grand structure, built under the personal supervision of Emperor Basil I, served as a repository for holy relics and influenced the development of the cross-in-square style that would become a hallmark of later Byzantine churches. To shed more light on the historical significance of this consecration, we now turn to our religion correspondent, Pastor Kevin Monstrance.
Good evening, good evening. Blessings upon you all. Now, I must begin by addressing a rather curious incident that occurred just prior to taking the stage. You see, our esteemed producer, Mr. Reginald Tuffington Smythe III, approached me with a most peculiar request. He said, "Pastor Kevin, might I have a private word?" Well, I assumed he wished to discuss tonight's historical focus, the consecration of the Nea Ecclesia Church in Constantinople back in 880 AD. A pivotal moment, to be sure, marking the start of the Middle Byzantine architectural period, this innovative cross-in-square design would go on to influence countless Orthodox churches across the empire. But no, Reginald had other matters on his mind entirely. "Pastor," he said, wringing his hands, "I find myself in a dreadful predicament. You see, I've mislaid my lucky cheese string." He looked at me imploringly. Now, I pride myself on maintaining an open mind, but I must admit, even I was taken aback. a cheese string as a lucky talisman. How bizarre, though I suppose we all have our little quirks. Why, I once knew a verger who couldn't start his day without aligning all the hymn books by colour spectrum. At any rate, I inquired as to the nature of this cheesy predicament. Reginald explained that every show night for the past 27 years, he has kept a singular string of low-moisture mozzarella in his breast pocket as a token of good fortune. An odd tradition, but a tradition nonetheless. Without it, I fear disaster, Kevin. Absolute catastrophe. The cameras will malfunction, the set will collapse. A passing meteor may even obliterate the studio. You simply must help me find it. Well, I tried to be a calming influence. I reminded him that the Nea Ecclesia itself was commissioned by that most pious Byzantine emperor, Basil I. Built to house Christendom's holiest relics, it stood as a monument to mankind's spiritual fortitude in the face of adversity. Surely we could soldier on without his dairy-based amulet. But Reginald would not be swayed. He beseeched me to retrace his steps, scouring every nook and cranny until the accursed string revealed itself. So we set off on our quest, leaving a trail of mild cheddar and Wensleydale in our wake. 3 hours and 17 minutes later, having turned the studio upside down, Reginald finally spotted his prize tucked behind the water cooler. "My precious!" he cried, clutching it to his bosom like a newborn babe. Honestly, you'd think he'd found the holy prepuce itself. And that, my friends, is how I came to be standing before you this evening, flustered, frazzled, yet ultimately victorious over the dreaded case of the missing cheese string. If nothing else, it proves that the most seemingly insignificant things can hold great power when imbued with tradition and personal meaning. Much like the Nea Ecclesia Church itself, a modest structure in its day, yet pivotal in shaping the Byzantine religious experience for centuries to come. Its relics and iconography bound the empire's faithful together through strife and upheaval. An enduring legacy, you might say, built not from marble but from the very soul of Christendom. So let us appreciate the little things that provide spiritual sustenance, be they churches, cheese strings, or, well, I suppose I'd best move on before this analogy gets any mustier. Thank you again for your patience and blessings upon your evening.
And now, the final roundup of tomorrow's front pages. The Times: Minneapolis mill explosion, 18 dead in dust debacle. Nasse Dastok Kues. The Independent: Zagreb under siege, rockets rain on Croatian capital. The Guardian have gone with Odesa clash, 48 fall in fray between factions. And that's the end of tonight's news bang. Remember tomorrow's weather forecast: spells of rain, spells of dry weather, and spells of witchcraft. Until next time, keep your headlines rolling and your puns folded. Good night.
Tune in next time for more artificially intelligent hilarity. Newsbang is a comedy show written and recorded by AI. All voices impersonated. Nothing here is real. Good night.